All right, everybody, welcome into the Salt City Hoops podcast. We're coming off an excellent loss, if you will, for the Utah Jazz, going down by just 4 points to the San Antonio Spurs, 109-105, in their first nationally televised game of the year. Leif Enes-Kanter ended up with 25 points, 11 rebounds, and the team made a spirited comeback at the end, but unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, wasn't able to pull out the win in the end. So tonight we wanted to talk about the future of 2014 for the Utah Jazz. We're about halfway through the month of January, and so there's still a lot of time left. And this is an important year for the franchise, so we wanted to go through a couple of questions and try to predict the future here, get out our crystal balls and try to figure out what will happen throughout the rest of the 2014 year. So with me today, I have Denim Millward. He's one of our weekly writers, now is back in school, but is still a contributor to Salt City Hoops. And we've got Clint Johnson here, also another awesome contributor to Salt City Hoops, just did an excellent series on Derek Favors. So welcome, both of you guys.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I'm Andy Larson. I'm not sure if I said that already, but we'll go ahead and get started. And we'll kind of do – we've got six questions on the docket here, and we'll get kind of the – answers from all three of us, try to figure out what us three Jazz personalities, if you will, have to think about these things in Jazzland. So the first question, we'll go kind of chronologically here. The Jazz player who will open the most eyes in the second half of the season is blank. Clint, who do you have in mind for this question?
I think I'll pick the low-hanging fruit, and I'll say Enes-Kanter. It's probably kind of the obvious answer because of all of the young players on the Jazz, he's probably had the most disappointing beginning to the season. And I think that, I mean, as a starter, he was playing 32 minutes and producing 14 points and 7 rebounds. Since he shifted to the bench role, he's only been getting 21 minutes a night and scoring 9 points and 5 rebounds, and it clearly has affected his confidence. For a number 3 pick who is clearly central to the Jazz plans in the future, you know that he can't keep getting 21 minutes a night. Even if he were to stay on the bench, he can't be getting those minutes. And so I think that a resurgence for Enes-Kanter is fairly easy to predict, quite frankly.
Yeah, no, I think that's a reasonable call. You know, you're right that Kanter is, you know, probably will be getting more minutes in the season and has underperformed both to expectations and what he did last year. You know, I guess my one reaction to what you said is I don't know if he stays on the bench how many more minutes he can really get than that 21 minutes a game when you really take into consideration that, you know, Ty Corbin doesn't like to make that first sub until 7 minutes into the game, ditto with the third quarter, and then you're looking at, you know, will Enes-Kanter finish games? He did tonight, but given how well the stretched lineup has been working, maybe that's not the best thing to do. Anyway, before I get your reaction on that, what's your answer to this question, Denim?
Well, Clint kind of stole my answer. I was going to pick Kanter too. I guess that is pretty much the low-hanging fruit. But besides Kanter, I guess I'll go with the second lowest-hanging fruit and say Alec Burks. Of course, Alec is, prior to this game, he's coming off probably his best game as a pro in that performance against the Thunder. I really think that Alec either has the potential to at least insert himself into the conversation for sixth man of the year. That's, of course, assuming he doesn't, either by injury or just by virtue of his play, doesn't, you know, essentially shoehorn himself into the starting lineup. Now, that could be also, you know, if there's a deal made and Richard Jefferson or even Marvin Williams gets shipped off, but he seems like he's been playing with a lot more poise and a lot more patience, and he knows a lot better when to attack now instead of just kind of throwing himself wildly at the hoop, basically. So I would say Alec Burks. I really think, even though he's already kind of started to take off and started his ascent, I think he's gonna go even farther and do even more as the season goes on.
Yeah, Alec Burks was my answer to this too, and I think that's just because I think people around the NBA have higher expectations for Enes-Kanter and kind of know a little bit what Kanter is all about, whereas Burks is kind of an unknown commodity. honestly, most of that's just their draft position, because one was the number 3 guy and one was the number 12 guy. You know, you expect more from that number 3 player, and a lot more eyes on the in the NBA are on that higher pick. I don't think that people know just how talented Alec Burks is, especially around the hoop and driving to the hole. And I think, you know, his production, especially in, what was that, Monday night's game, could definitely open up a lot of eyes around the NBA. Clint, I want to get back to you just regarding that Enes Kanter point. How do you think he does get those more than 21 minutes per game?
I agree with you. I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to get him the minutes that he needs, and that I think that everybody in the organization, including Coach Corbin, would say he needs, as long as he's coming off the bench. Because even when he's getting more minutes, it often siphons as much from Derek Favors as it does from Marvin Williams or one of the other bigs, because the Jazz have just recently been so much more effective with that stretch four out there spacing the floor, that that when Kanter's been kind of waxing, Favors' minutes have dipped a little bit. And I just I don't think that that's sustainable, but the pattern is very clear that it's been impossible to get both of them substantial minutes with Kanter coming off the bench, or at least it has been thus far.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the issue moving forward. And I think what may happen is, you know, you may have some entropy moving forward with either Favors, Kanter, or even someone like Jeremy Evans or Marvin Williams getting hurt, or, you know, something like that should happen, then one of those guys, the minutes will have to adjust based on that. I think there's going to be more entropy in this Jazz season as we move along. Anyway, let's go on to the next question. Let's keep this kind of rapid fire if we can. The February 20th trade deadline is coming up in about a month here. Who will be traded before the February 20th trade deadline? I'll start with Denim this time.
Well, I think the obvious choice is Richard Jefferson. He's a long-time vet, you know, 10-plus years in the league. I'm not sure how long exactly, but he does bring it, you know, he's certainly not the Richard Jefferson, the dunk contest era Richard Jefferson, but he brings a skill set. He brings some scoring punch. His 3-point percentage has improved quite a bit from last year. He's, I believe, throughout it, just this is just off the top of my head, but I believe throughout his career he's been pretty close to a 38% to 40% 3-point shooter. Last year he dipped all the way down to about 30%, and this year I think he's closer to his career numbers. So, you know, could he be eighth or ninth man on a decent contending team? I sure think he could, and if the Jazz can get much of, you know, any decent value out of dealing Jefferson, I definitely think that they'll go ahead and pull the trigger on that.
How about you, Clint?
My answer would be Marvin Williams, largely because of the things that we talked about with Kanter. I mean, I think Marvin has been great for this team. When the Jazz picked him up, when they got him last season, I was really excited because I thought that from the first time he was coming to the Jazz, I thought he'd be an exceptional stretch four. So I am not surprised by his success this season. I'm a little surprised by how drastic the influence has been on the offense. The team has just been so much better since he was inserted into the starting lineup. I think there's a number of things that contribute to that, but he's certainly one of the major catalysts. But I think the inescapable truth is that the Jazz have 2 third overall picks on this roster that play power forward and center, and they didn't draft Enes Kanter to come off the bench. They drafted Kanter to pair him with Favors and have a front court that they could use for the better part of a decade to contend with. And at the beginning of the season, that pairing was so disastrously poor. I mean, it was bad on the offensive end and atrocious on the defensive end, that their choices, they really didn't have a choice, or at least Coach Corbin didn't have a choice but to put Marvin Williams in the starting lineup. But that could never, to my mind, be a long-term solution, because the long-term plan is not to alternate Favors and Kanter. The long-term plan is to ride those two big horses as far as they'll take the Jazz team. And it's easy to focus on the goal of this season for the Utah Jazz in getting a high draft pick, trying to get the franchise player that so excites the fan base. But for management, I think an equally important question is to have a year of honest assessment of what they already have on the team. And if you don't have more games with Favors and Cantor both sharing considerable time on the floor than they have already, I think that goal of the season is a failure. They have to see if those two players can be on the floor at the same time, if they can coexist, and if they can be complementary pieces. And based on Tyrone Corbin's history, and as long as Marvin Williams is playing as well as he does and has the effect that he does on the floor, I simply don't see any possibility whatsoever where Marvin Williams can be on this team and be healthy and for the Jazz to be able to honestly assess Favors and Cantor as a duo.
Yeah, Clint, I think that's a good point. And, you know, if this were around the horn, I'm giving the points to you. Not only because of what you said, but I think also the big deal when you're making trades is the salaries of both men. In particular, Richard Jefferson's got that $11 million salary that makes him extremely hard to trade, you know, at least one-to-one. You know, players within the 25% of him include players like Tim Duncan, Al Horford, you know, and even the bad players who have that kind of salary, like Andrea Bargnani. The Knicks don't have a pick to give up, even if they wanted to dump Bargnani onto the Jazz. You know, there's just not a whole lot of fits there for a team to be able to make that trade for Richard Jefferson. Then you start to get into the age difference. I believe Marvin Williams is 28. And
I think he's 27.
Is he 27?
I think he's still 27.
I mean, so, yeah, you're still in the 20s for Marvin. Richard Jefferson is 33, so, you know, you've got different issues there. You know, basically, you have a lot of trade value in Marvin Williams, and I think the Jazz kind of miss a boat once this Andrew Bynum contract is gone. I don't know that there's anyone else in this $10 to $14 million range that they could conceivably trade Richard Jefferson for, so... That's my response to that question. I agree with you, Clint. The clear answer to me is Marvin Williams. Next question. Let's move on. At season's end, the Jazz will have won how many games this year? And what position will this give them in terms of worst record in the league? Clint, I'll start with you this time.
Okay. Going into the season, I thought they would win 26, 27 games. They've surprised me with... how competent they've looked recently. But between injuries and trades and the Western Conference just being brutal, I haven't upped that number that much. I think they'll win maybe 28 games, and I think that will put them probably right around fifth worst record in the league. I think the Bucks are out of everyone's class when it comes to stinking up the floor. And then I think the Sixers, the Magic, and the Celtics I'm picking as we'll all have worse records than the Jazz, but with the trade to bring in Luol Deng, I think the Cavs are going to try to win, and I think they will successfully win more than the Jazz. And I just look at Sacramento and I say they're so talented, and they have a coach that's pushing them hard. I just think that they'll manage to scrape together a few more wins. So I think the Jazz are probably about fifth worst record in the league.
Interesting. Okay, Denham?
I have a pretty similar answer. I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe that I heard a stat from one of the announcers in the game tonight that the Jazz were at or close to 500 since, I want to say Thanksgiving. I'm not sure if that's correct or if it's later. Maybe it was since December.
Yeah, anywho, the team started out 1-14, and since then they've been 12-13 with the loss tonight. So they were at 500 since that Thanksgiving date, and then... You know, with the loss tonight, they're not quite there, but still have played significantly better.
Right, so they're at about 500 now. Certainly, with a few possible trades coming, that could potentially sink to possible win total. Maybe they don't quite keep that pace, but I have the Jazz actually at 30-52 on the year. I would estimate that puts them at about the sixth or seventh worst record in the league. I think, like Clint was saying, Milwaukee's clearly the, you know, the leaders in the Tankapalooza, the Riggin' for Wiggins, sorry for Jabari, Bleed for Embiid, whatever you want to call it. Orlando's right there with them. I think Philadelphia, despite having a lot of talent on that team, I think they may need to work hard to maybe ship Evan Turner somewhere to throw their hat in that number one pick ring. I believe the Jazz
Denham,
will
are you
also.
there? I think we lost. Okay.
Sorry. I think the Jazz will also finish ahead of the
No,
Lakers.
that's
Maybe.
fine. Go ahead.
I think there's some lag there. Sorry about that. I think the Jazz will also finish ahead of the Lakers. I think we'll have an outside but not non-existent chance for the number one pick, and I think we'll end the season on a pretty good note.
Interesting. So sixth or seventh pick, you know, not in that top five group that Chad Ford talked about today in the in his ESPN big board. I guess I'm more pessimistic than you guys. I think, you know, I have two minds about this. First of all, the Jazz have had one of the hardest schedules in the league so far this season, maybe the hardest. And so you look to have an easier schedule down the road. That being said, at the end of tonight, the Jazz still have the third worst record in the league. You know, so you're in that top three right now. And I guess I still think things have gone pretty well for the Jazz, especially like we've talked about since Thanksgiving. You know, we look at Hayward's injury. We don't know how much longer that will keep him out. And then ultimately, I think that a trade of someone like Marvin Williams or Richard Jefferson puts someone like Ian Clark or even forces John Lucas to get more minutes at the wing, and then, you know, this team starts to get really bad really quickly. I just think that over, again, 42 more games in the NBA season, you're going to have a little bit more entropy and get some more injuries, even if those injuries aren't always real all the time if they have to be. I think this organization's very focused on getting as good as a draft pick as possible, so they'll do that with trades and, you know, do whatever it takes in order to get there. I predict the Jazz end up with 25 wins, and I think that puts them in the third worst record in the league, kind of staying exactly where we are right now.
Interesting. I can see that. I just the one reason why I've upped my the number of games I expect them to win is I'm really more impressed than I thought I would be with a young core of players, and I think as long as they're missing no more than say one of those guys, unless it's maybe Trey Burke or Derek Favors, then I think that their performance is not going to drop as much as I originally anticipated it would, especially with Alec Burks really playing well enough that I think he can make up for more of what Hayward offers than I thought he would be able to do. So, but I can see something in the mid, even getting down to the low 20 wins it, depending on what happens with the team and if they do milk injuries for everything they're worth.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, and I think that, you know, it makes sense for the Jazz organizationally to do that.
Yeah.
So given that slot where we predicted them in the record in the league, by the end of June 26th, which is the date of the NBA draft, the Utah Jazz will have what player? And I guess the follow-up question is, how will they get there? You know, if you predicted them to get the sixth worst record in the league, you know, do you move up or down? Do you think the Jazz have the assets to get one of those top five guys, for example, Denham? Or do the Jazz stay, you know, and draft someone like a Marcus Smart? Who do you think they end up with in this draft, Denham?
Well, I think Dennis Lindsay showed us last year he's willing to wheel and deal to move up to get a player he likes. I think a combination of maybe packaging the two first round picks we'll have, plus even one of the young assets they have, a Cantor, possibly a Hayward. I don't see that quite as likely. And then I know statistically this is ridiculous to even bring it up, but I think we're after the unlucky coin flip we had with the because of the coin flip, they ended up getting Harrison Barnes, and we ended up getting nothing for that year. I think that we're due for a little luck. So a combination of those factors, I do think that puts us into the top two or three picks. And I think we end up with Jabari Parker. Maybe just my blind optimism, but like I said, with the fact that the Jazz are really this bad so infrequently, the fact that Jabari will likely declare for the draft after this college season. Obviously, we have the LDS connection there. To me, again, this is ridiculous and nothing to do with anything statistically significant, but to me, combining all those factors, it just seems preordained. So I say we come away with Jabari Parker.
I would throw out one note that I think the Jazz made up for that unlucky coin flip by being lucky in the draft when they moved up from number 6 to number 3 in the lottery to be able to take Enes Kanter. Clint, your response.
Well, first I'll say what I think they will try to do. I think they will try to package both of their first-round picks with Kanter, Burks, or I believe that Hayward may even be on the table as well. And I think they might even throw a future protected first in there, but they'll only make the offer for one of the top three picks, specifically for Jabari Parker or Andrew Wiggins, whichever of those is on the board the longest, and I don't think that it's going to get that pick. I do not think that a top two or three pick in this draft is going to be given up by a team for anything short of seven King's ransoms. So I think the Jazz are going to offer a lot to try to get either Parker or Wiggins, and I don't think that it's going to work. So I project them as having the fifth worst.
So what's plan B, I guess?
Yeah, plan B, I think, if they have the fifth worst record, I would actually count on them having pick 6 or 7, to tell you the truth. And I guess because I'm the opposite of Denim, I guess I'm a pessimist. And I just assume that at least one team jumps them. And so if you are picking 6th or 7th, I think that the players that most teams are, you know, so intoxicated with as being future franchise players, I think those guys are largely off the board. And they're probably looking at, you know, maybe an Aaron Gordon, who's an exciting prospect but is really raw. And I think that they end up with Marcus Smart, to tell you the truth. I think that they move up a couple of picks by giving up less, and I think they maybe move, say, a Burks to get a Marcus Smart.
Interesting. Yes, just for those listening, the lottery odds, as far as if you are in that fifth slot, you have a much higher chance of going down. You actually have about a 50% chance of moving down to number 6 or number 7 compared to staying at 5 or moving up into the top 3. You've got about a 27% chance of moving up into that top 3, 26% chance moving at top 5, and at staying at 5, excuse me, and then about a 48% chance of moving down. So just so you know, it's about a coin flip whether or not the Jazz would be able to stay or advance or even slip down in at that number 5 spot. You know, like you, Clint, I just don't think that the Jazz, that any of those teams in that top three in a position to take Andrew Wiggins or Jabari Parker would give up that opportunity for the package that Jazz fans are talking about offering, you know, kind of the second or third worst out of the core youth, plus the number 23 pick right now is where Golden State would be. I don't know that that's going to move the needle at all in terms of negotiations. Remember, the Jazz got the 27th pick last year just for cash alone. So, you know, it's just really difficult to see how the Jazz could package those assets unless the team was, you know, really in salary states, hard-pressed in terms of salary and needed to dump a contract. But I think most of the time these GMs are smart enough to know that you just don't trade those kind of top three picks that get you the elite NBA players. Now, I think the good news for the Jazz is, based on my answer for the earlier question, I think they do end up in that bottom three and are able to get Jabari Parker in the end, just because I do think that Joel Embiid and Andrew Wiggins will end up going ahead of Jabari Parker. I'm not as big of a fan of him just because of some of the defensive and positional worries, but I think that it does make so much sense for the Jazz to draft him. And he is a great player, you know, coming out of college immediately, that I think just the fit works too well. If the Jazz are that third pick in the draft, I think they end up with Jabari Parker.
Well, you just made a lot of people happy.
Hey, so Denim did first.
This is true. This is true.
I would also throw in there real quick that if they do miss out on someone like Parker, they can't piece it together. I could see him taking someone like Rodney Hood or someone else, maybe one of the second tier type of players who could excel for them at the small forward position.
Even, you know, Rodney Hood, even at somewhere like the 5th or 6th pick.
Yeah, I mean, it may seem like somewhat of a reach, but I have seen him climbing up some draft boards as high as it looks like NBA draft.net has him at 8. Okay. So I could see him going somewhere around there. Of course, things are going to change so much between now and then that I think draft stocks are going to, you know, I'm sure there's going to be a handful of guys who jump up into the lottery that might, maybe not, aren't even projected first rounders right now, and plenty are going to fall out too. So.
Yeah, I'm excited, by the way, Clint, for your next NBA draft prospect roundup, hopefully coming this month, just because it's what I use and I think one of the best tools out there for Jazz fans and really NBA fans to keep abreast of what's happening in the college ranks. So thanks for writing those. We'll watch out for the next one.
Yep, I'm working on it right now.
Perfect. All right, so question number 5 of 6 tonight. Looking forward to the beginning of next season, the starting lineup of the Utah Jazz to begin the 2014-2015 NBA season will be. How do you think the Jazz's starting lineup changes next year?
I'll start with that. I think it's going to be Trey Burke, Gordon Hayward, Derek Favors, Enes Kanter, and Marcus Smart. Like I said, I think that the Jazz are not going to get their plan A in the draft, and I think that Dennis Lindsay is serious about wanting to go with defense, and Marcus Smart doesn't have the prototypical height, but he's really long, he's very strong, he's a super intense defender, and I think that they would be really interested in the possibility of having three very good passers with Burke, Smart, and Hayward. And so I'm going out on a limb and I'm saying that'll be the starting lineup.
Interesting. Then I think that's reasonable. Denim, what's your lineup like?
I have Burke, Hayward, Favors, Kanter, and Jabari Parker. I think Alec Burks has certainly earned a spot in the starting lineup. A little bit, and of course this is just going off of tonight's game against the Spurs, but it seems to me like his offensive abilities maybe get blunted a little bit when he's in the starting lineup with so many other potential offensive players. Even tonight without Hayward, it seemed like that they weren't looking for him early. Now, of course, that was in part because Favors and Kanter had started off so well. But so I think that it would be good to keep him as a potential six-man scoring punch when most of the second unit is in. But and, of course, if you have a top three pick and you use it to draft someone like Jabari Parker, who is universally regarded as one of the most NBA-ready prospects in the draft, I don't believe that you would draft him to bring him off the bench. I think he would start immediately.
Do you think he makes more sense as a small forward than a power forward?
I do. It's kind of, I don't want to call it the Rudy Gay conundrum, but that's what it reminded me of a little bit. I just think that a lot of the bigger, more physical power forwards in the NBA, especially with Parker's not exactly amazing defense, I think a lot of those people could give him fits, and if he's getting beaten up that bad on the defensive end, I certainly think that it could adversely affect him on the offensive end where he really excels.
I think that's a good call. Interesting. Yeah, I think, you know, my starting lineup matches exactly with Denham's just because I also thought we would also get Jabari Parker. In the end, I think Gordon Hayward stays as a Jazz man just like as you guys do. Ultimately, I think his play has been good but not great, and so I don't think that he gets that max contract extension that he wants from a team. And then so the Jazz do either sign him directly or match a contract for around $11 to $13 million per. And then I think just Trey Burke, of course, I think the Jazz are going to keep at this point. Enes Kanter is kind of the question mark left there. And ultimately the Jazz have him locked up for at least the next 2 seasons, or season and a half, excuse me. So it just, unless they are able to swing a trade where they get something for Kanter, I think he's here for the foreseeable future. And honestly, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to sign a starting caliber center that would hurt the minutes of Derek Favors and Kanter any further. So I'm with Denham starting lineup there. I think it makes a lot of sense for both sides. Although, honestly, your Marcus Smart defensive lineup I like as well just because of, what it does give you on the defensive end. Final question, and this is a big one and the one that will worry Jazz fans for months to come. On opening night of the 2014-2015 NBA season, Ty Corbin will be coach of the Utah Jazz, not coach, assistant coach, coach of, I don't know, some other team, coach of a college team. What's Ty Corbin up to at opening night next year?
I'll go ahead and start off with this one. This one was by far the hardest question I had. I would say that Ty will be enjoying a cold drink on a beach somewhere, unemployed. This is really tough for me, like I said, because, one, I think I've been a lot more of a Ty defender and supporter than a lot of the Twitterverse, I guess you could say. But I do think that there's a and part of the reason why it's so difficult to tell is because you really wonder how truthful Dennis Lindsay is being when he says that Ty will be judged on player development and things like that rather than just wins. I mean, of course, if he was going to be judged solely on wins this year, I think that it would be not much of a question that he would be out the door. But it really, to me, the hard part of evaluating it is if you're going by player development, I think communication with the players, relationship with the players goes a long way with that, and we have such a limited view of that that it's really hard to say with any level of certainty unless you're someone like, you know, Aaron Falk or Jody Ginnessy that has a very regular interaction and is around the players and Ty a lot and sees how they interact, sees how good of a rapport he has with them, that it's very difficult to say how good of a job he's doing specifically in that. Of course, he's doing things that drive us all crazy, I think. You know, if Richard Jefferson's contract's so difficult to trade, and the goal for this year isn't necessarily winning, but it's developing players, and you certainly wonder why Jefferson gets so many minutes each night. I just think that with a handful of pretty good former coaches on available right now, such as the Van Gundys, and then you have Jerry Sloan in the mix still. So conspiracy theorists will still wonder if that will come, if anything there will come to fruition if Coach Sloan takes back over. It puts me at about 52% that he's going to be fired, or he won't be re-signed, I guess, or he won't be retained since his contract is up. 48% of me thinks that he'll be back, so it's really close, but ultimately I'm going to say no, he won't be back as the coach.
Interesting. I want to jump in just before Clint responds and just note that in my time with the team, you know, having the credential and being able to be around Ty Corbin and the young guys, their rapport is pretty excellent. Like, I think that's honestly what Corbin is best at, is getting those young guys to get on board and work hard and work on their development. I honestly think that he's an excellent coach on that. Whether or not that's shown on the court is a more interesting question, but I'll get into my response in a second. Clint, where are you going with this?
Of all the questions, this is the most difficult for me as well. Much like Denim, I find that more often than not, I'm acting as a defender of Coach Corbin, perhaps more to the degree than I personally am a fan of his coaching, especially his methods. Some of the methods I disagree with, just as I think a majority of fans disagree with a number of the things that he does. But my answer is going to be that on opening night, I think that he will be coaching his first game under his new 3-year extension. I think that they keep him. I think they retain him. And the reason is that when I look at his performance, if you look at coaching as a performance-based occupation where it's all about the result, when I look back over the last several years, this year's team is performing slightly better than I expected, and I am pleased with the development of the young players. Last season, I think the team performed a little worse than I expected, and the year before that, they performed a little better than I expected. And so, to me, he has more often than not produced a team that did better than I expected the team to do. Pair that with the Jazz's reputation of being very loyal, very conservative of appreciating a coach like Corbin, who's more old school, who shares that loyalty, who values that hard work ethic. And I agree with you, Andy. I think that when I ask myself, what is it that Tyrone Corbin brings to the table? What is his skill? We always talk about basketball players in terms of their skills. What NBA skill do they have? Well, I ask myself, what NBA coaching skill does Tyrone Corbin have? And I think what you hear from the team a lot and from what I see is that I think that he does foster genuine positive relationships with his players. And for a team that is anchoring its future in lots of young players that have experience with this guy to this point, I don't think they're going to make a change when they're, you know, 22, 21 years old and things have been going pretty well. I see a 3-year extension as the most likely outcome. And then if at the end of that point he has shown that he is not going to be the type of coach that is going to be able to do the X's and O's to make the calculated decisions to compete for championships, they can move on, and their core is still in their mid-20s. So I don't think that the Jazz see this as a be-all or end-all choice right now, as unpopular as my belief would be with most Jazz fans.
Interesting. Yeah, I see a lot of what you say, and I think you're right on a lot of it. To me, like you pointed out, the two best aspects of Ty Corbin is that rapport with his players. I mean, he clearly gets it, and his players clearly enjoy playing under him. And then just the ability to promote the work ethic around the team. Mike D'Antoni came in a couple of weeks ago and couldn't stop talking about how the Jazz continually fight hard as a team and how rare that is, and how that's the most important asset for a coach to have, is be able to promote his team to work hard, to have everybody on board and you know, implement a system and continue just working hard. Honestly, through an 82-game season is not something that most NBA teams do. That being said, Dennis Lindsay said that he was judging Ty Corbin and the team this year on defense, development, and discipline. Discipline, I think the team's done really well at. You know, you look at things like Derek Favors' foul trouble and how much he's developed there. I think that's a big deal. And development, honestly, has been good in a lot of cases. You look at how Alec Burks has played in the last few games. I don't think he would be capable of that. And in fact, he said, when I asked him this, he said he wouldn't have been capable of this his rookie year. You know, he has developed in his time with the Jazz. Enes Kanter, on the other hand, has dropped off a little bit, but it's that third D defense that really worries me. The Jazz are worst in the league, 30th in the league defensively, with 109.9 points given up in defensive rating. Honestly, I just don't see how a team can win while being that bad defensively. And, you know, prior to the season and for SLC Dunk last year, I wrote an article basically blaming the whole thing on Al Jefferson. I looked at that the Jazz were a bad defensive team with Al Jefferson and Jerry Sloan, and were bad with Ty Corbin and Al Jefferson. So therefore, you know, it's presumably Al Jefferson's fault. That being said, the Charlotte Bobcats right now, I believe, are the fifth best defense in the league. Recently they were third. I think they've dropped back down to fifth, and Basketball Reference tells me eighth, but regardless, they have a top 10 defense with Al Jefferson as their starting center. Now the Jazz have the worst defense in the league with Derek Favors, who should be an excellent defensive center. I just don't think that the Jazz are going to be happy with that defensive performance. And in the end, that's half of the ballgame. I don't know that Dennis Lindsay and co. will be happy with that, given the other coaching talent that's out there.
That is the one thing that causes me to question whether Corbin will be back. The things that bother most fans, I think that management is willing to say, you know, you're the coach, you handle it your way, you make these decisions, you just need to meet these benchmarks and these expectations. But I do think the one benchmark that has been given in public that I think is a clear problem right now is on the defensive end. So I do agree that that is a problem, and I would expect that in the second half of the season, that would be something that Coach Corbin would be highly focused on, because to me, how the Jazz performed defensively in the last half of the season is probably what determines whether he gets his extension.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would, I guess, throw out that it's going to be hard to be significantly better than, you know, I don't see any way that you can make this team into take it out of the bottom 10, if you will, defensively, just because of their really, really poor start to the year.
Yeah.
And honestly, the start of the year matters just as much as the end of the year, maybe more so with how the team may trade some guys at the end of the year, and you know, as a team that's completely out of playoff contention starts maybe slowing its roll a little bit. Denim, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would wonder that if Dennis Lindsay and the front office, how much, if at all, they would be influenced on seeing the success of Jeff Hornacek, you know, a first-year head coach with no coaching experience, and to even some extent Brad Stevens. Of course, the Celtics aren't going anywhere, but I think Brad Stevens has done a lot of really great things with an incredibly limited roster talent-wise. Again, Dennis Lindsay doesn't strike me as someone who chases trends, but at the same time, and also by no means is Ty Corbin an old coach, nor do I think his message has gotten stale with the players. But I do wonder the evident, I guess, infusion of enthusiasm, energy, and again, especially if they get a young, high energy coach who's maybe known as a defensive specialist. I wonder if that is kind of what is the nail in the coffin for Coach Corbin next year.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. And if you can get someone like a Mike Longobardi, or you know, someone even like a Stan Van Gundy, who's shown an ability to coach good defensive teams in the past, I think it makes sense. Tom Thibodeau even may be available with some of the drama that's happened in Chicago over the last season. So I think there will be some good names available. And ultimately, I think the Jazz will want someone who's better defensively coaching-wise, and then we'll also kind of embrace analytics. I think Ty embraces analytics more than people think he does, but the fact of the matter is that on the floor, the results haven't really shown, and the Jazz still kind of lag behind in that movement towards modern basketball, if you will. So anyway, I think that wraps up our six questions. I think we had a lot of good disagreements here, which is fun. You know, we'll see what happens throughout the course of 2014. I want to thank my two guests, Denim Millward and Clint Johnson, for joining me on the Salt City Hoops podcast this week. My name is Andy Larson. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.